welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Many of our regular listeners, many of you, are kind enough to email suggestions for future topics. And the single biggest theme that comes through those suggestions every time is, where do I find growth for my portfolio? Where do the most exciting opportunities lie and how do I access them? Today I'm speaking with Dr. Mary Manning of Elliston Capital about the growth engine of the world. That is Asia, to help you understand what opportunities and risks present themselves for investors looking to invest in this region. Mary is the portfolio manager of Elliston Asian Investments. It's an LIC listed on the ASX. She was formerly with Oaktree Capital in New York and Singapore, has worked with Soros Funds Management. She's massively showing off with all of these things and investing in Asia for over two decades now. Mary, thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me, Gemma.
So Mary, let's start with the absolute basics. You've been doing this for a really long time. Asia is a huge and diverse continent with an equally huge and diverse population. What are the big themes that you're interested in and what opportunities do you think they present for investors?
Okay, so there's four main themes that we think are going to play out throughout Asia over the long term. So the first is the rise of the Asia consumer, and many Australian investors have heard of this before. It's not a new thematic, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. There are 4.5 billion people in Asia. So that's, that is a lot of consumers, and particularly compared to the size of the Australian consumer market, there are opportunities there that are going to continue over time. We break that thematic down into some smaller thematics in terms of, we consider any good where the end consumer is a person, or the end, so for example, we consider healthcare a consumer good. If you go to a hospital, that's a consumption good. We consider a lot of tech goods consumer goods, because if you go to the shop and you buy an iPhone, that's a consumer good. So we take a very broad view of consumer, and we think that the rise of the middle class in Asia, particularly in countries like India, is going to create huge demand for a lot of different consumer products. So that's one thematic we think that is going to continue to play out over time. The second thing is structural reform in India. So India is a country that I'm very passionate about. I've been investing in India for over 15 years, and I think now is one of the best times, certainly in my investing lifetime, to be interested in India. So a lot of these structural reform things have been instigated by Prime Minister Modi. When he was elected in 2014, he made a number of very impressive changes: demonetization, introducing the GST, housing for all, infrastructure, and these things are really powering the Indian economy forward. So India has the highest growth rate in our Asian universe. It's growing about 7.4%. So that's, you know, almost 2 to 3 times higher than what Australian growth is. I guess a third thematic that we really like is technological disruption in Asia. So, you know, everywhere in the world people are talking about tech. There's not a business or a country that's sort of immune to this technological disruption. But Asia is in a really unique scenario because there's leapfrogging going on. So I'll take e-commerce as an example. In a lot of countries like America or Australia, before there was e-commerce, there was a huge build out of shopping malls, and there was a shopping mall in a strip mall or a Westfield in every major part of Australia. In a lot of developing countries, that build out hasn't happened yet, but now everybody has a phone and everybody can get Alibaba or can get Amazon or can get Flipkart. That's the Indian, sort of the Alibaba of India. And so that whole build out of malls may not even happen. So there's a lot of, you know, leapfrogging going on in Asian tech. I guess the other thing that we like about disruptive tech in Asia is that there's the supply chain. So I don't know if you have an iPhone. I have an iPhone. But about 85% of the stuff in that iPhone was made in Asia. And it was assembled in Asia also. Mm. So that is a really big part of technology in Asia that you don't get in terms of other markets. And then in terms of the really new and emerging, very disruptive part of technology in Asia, there's things like robotics. People don't know this, but Asia is a leader in robotics globally. Germany is second, but the Asian region, particularly Japan and China, is first. Things like artificial intelligence, companies like Baidu, which is the Google of China, there's a whole technological arms race that's going on, and Google and Baidu are sort of at the front of these. There's also the e-commerce companies that I talked about, different biotechnology companies, fintech, and for Australian investors, this technology point is very, very important, because a lot of those things that I just talked about, you cannot get access to them at all in the domestic market. And people sort of cottoned on to this before and bought some of the FANG stocks. stocks in the US, but FANG is not the same as Asia Tech, so that's why we're really excited about technology in Asia. And then I guess the last thematic that I'll talk about is capital market liberalization in China. So what this means is for a very long time the Chinese market was closed. It was very difficult to invest in A shares, that's the local Chinese the stock exchanges like Shanghai and Shenzhen. It was very difficult for currency convertibility. China was for all intents and purposes a closed economy. Mm-hmm. Then obviously, 10, 15 years ago, that all started to thaw, but we're just in the middle of that process. So a couple of key things have happened recently. One is a few years ago, China started the Stock Connect. So what that means is that now if you're a foreign investor and you want to invest in A shares, it's very, very easy. You do it by the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. It's just like buying a normal stock. Similarly, for Chinese mainland investors who want to invest in Hong Kong, they just do it the other way on the Stock Connect. And it's very, very easy. It took out a lot of the risk and the hassle of having a certain license and certain tax ID and stuff. The second thing that's happening is that A shares, those have been, for the first time ever, led into MSCI indices. Mm-hmm. And you might think, oh, that's so weird. China is the third largest stock market in the world, A shares, mm-hmm. until it's fallen recently. Before that, it was the second largest stock market. Japan has recently surpassed it. But nevertheless, you have a top three stock market in the world, and it's not in any of the major indices. That is very weird. But MSCI has changed its classification, so now A shares are included, but just a little bit. Over time, that's going to grow to a proper weighting, and we think that that's going to cause a lot of flows into China. So that whole liberalization of the Chinese financial system is going to create a lot of opportunities. So yeah, I guess those would be our four main thematics that we look at in Asia.
They're all so powerful individually. It's quite fascinating. A few of them, obviously, people are aware of. I think certainly the rise of the consumer is a story we've been buying into for a long time, but how people approach it is different. I love your thoughts on India, but we've agreed to cover those in a separate podcast. So if you're listening to this and you want to hear more about India, hold tight. In a couple of weeks, we're going to release that one also, because it's utterly fascinating and it deserves a full conversation of its own. China, on the other hand, most Australian investors, they already buy that story about the rise of the Asian consumer, the Chinese consumer. Can you talk us through what you see as the biggest opportunities in China?
So I guess, like I said before, we don't just look at consumer as buying milk or buying baby powder or buying cosmetics or something like that. Mm-hmm. That is an extremely narrow definition of the consumer. So we break consumer into different sectors, like I said before. One is sort of the rise of e-commerce and buying consumption goods. And we feel quite strongly about playing that directly via Chinese companies. I get a lot of investors who say to me, oh, I don't need to own an Asia fund, I own Bellamy's. And that is it's a niche product in a niche part of the market in only one country in Asia. If you want exposure to the Asian consumer, that is, like you said at the beginning, a very, very diverse group of people, and you need to have a broad portfolio that covers it. You can't just get it through one stock. So there are the sort of classic consumption goods, and particularly e-commerce, which we think are very interesting. And secondly, healthcare is something that we think is very interesting in China. So, China, unlike the rest of or certain other Asian countries, particularly ASEAN countries like Philippines and Indonesia, and certainly India, China does have an aging population. And they do have an issue that, starting in the 1970s, there is one child policy. Mm-hmm. So the sort of population pyramid in China is all messed up, right? You have, eight grandparents and one kid trying to support them. Mm-hmm. So because of that, the demand for healthcare products as that aging population goes through in China is going to be quite big. So we like some of the pharma companies in China, and there aren't too many listed hospital companies, but those are some that we also look at. And then thirdly, in terms of consumption, we do like the technology companies. So, Alibaba is considered a technology company, but of course it's a consumer company. It's actually covered by our consumer analysts and not by our technology analysts. So we like companies like that, Alibaba, JD, Weibo is the Twitter of China, and again, there's technology involved there, but at the end of the day, it's consumers who are tweeting things and advertising that's going on in those stocks. So those are sort of where we see consumption going, and we also differentiate consumers on some other levels too. One would be male and female. Mm-hmm. So if you look at consumption patterns in China, there's very, very divergent consumption patterns versus males and females. So sometimes we look at the Korean cosmetic stocks, and the way females travel and what they buy when they travel. It's very different. Also, you know, Chinese males, what they buy in terms of technology consumption is also very specific, and you can identify very specific patterns there. So we don't just lump all consumers in together and say this is one thing. Also, like I said before, with healthcare, we differentiate between young and old, mm-hmm. and we differentiate between rural and urban. Mm-hmm. So we don't just, you know, this isn't some big blanket that goes over all Chinese consumers. And this, back to my point about, you know, Bellamy's or A2 milk, that is a really, really specific thing. We break China down into, you know, by age, by gender, by location, and then sort of by sector. And we think based on that, we get a lot of interesting access to the Chinese consumption thematic.
That's fascinating. So talking particularly about the consumer in China and this rise of the middle class, everyone's very nervous right now about rising trade tensions, that there's a strong perception that that has quite a bit of potential to impact that growth profile and many of the individuals within that growth profile, right? Your thoughts?
So I'm not, it's creating uncertainty, that is for sure. No one can say that they're not worried about it. There's no uncertainty out there. But the important thing to highlight about the Chinese economy is that they have a lot of levers. And this is something in the world of QE that people have forgotten about. So you remember during QE, you can't cut interest rates anymore, and there's really high deficits, so you can't really do fiscal spend anymore, and you can't do industrial policy anymore. And a lot of developed countries, you know, the policymakers, their hands were tied. China is not in that position at all. So what we've heard from our contacts on the ground is that if the trade war worsens from here, there are a lot of levers that they can pull. The first one is the Chinese government has been quite strict about deleveraging. So you know that the debt in China was getting quite high, and people were worried not necessarily about the level of debt, but the rate of growth of the debt. And I agree with that was a cause for concern. They have really, you know, taken their foot off the gas and put their foot on the brake in terms of deleveraging. If things start to get you know, slow down from a macro perspective, all they have to do is lift their foot a little bit off that brake, and they will add, you know, 20, 30 basis points back to GDP growth. The second thing is, you know, it's a classic sort of Keynesian and classic Chinese move, is that when things are going down, you can use infrastructure spend to prop up the economy, and you can let the property market run. So what's been happening in property recently is, or not recently, it's probably for, you know, 5-7 years now, is that in certain cities where the prices were getting too high, the government clamped down, and they put in all these sort of macroprudential regulation. They just remove those, and property will go back to its previous path. I'm sure you've heard about this One Belt, One Road, or the Belt and Road Initiative, BRI as it's called now. That is a huge infrastructure spend, not just in China, but in all countries around Asia and also going into Europe. And, you know, if the Chinese economy starts to slow down, they'll just spend more on infrastructure. And so I am not worried at all that the trade war will lead to a hard landing. Will growth go from 6.7% to 6.5%? Possibly. But I'm quite confident that China has a lot of levers. I guess maybe more high-level comment, are our views on the trade war that there's three possible outcomes. One is that this tit-for-tat escalation just continues. The second is that there's going to be some negotiated outcome. And the third is that there'd be some sort of extreme retaliation. So right now we're obviously in tit-for-tat. You can see that, oh, we're going to do 50 billion, well, we'll do 50 billion. We're going to do 60 billion, we're going to do 60. We're going to do 200, or we'll do... The problem with that is that the math doesn't work very well for China, because obviously the deficit with the U.S. means that the U.S. can keep escalating that, and China will run out of room. So that's sort of where we are now. The way China has responded thus far, in addition to, you know, their tit-for-tat escalation, is by depreciating the RMB. My personal view is that's also sort of run its course. The RMB got to about 6.9 to the US dollar at its, you know, recent peak. And I think the PBOC, that's the central bank in China, would be very nervous about letting it go past 7. That's a big psychological level for people. So I think that now there is some chance for negotiation. As I'm sure you've heard in the news, there's going to be a very low-level group of delegates go actually later this week to America to talk with their counterparts there. And then there is also, the Wall Street Journal has reported that in November there's going to be a meeting between Trump and Xi. So at least now the communication channels seem to be open, even if it's between sort of low-level delegates, at least people are talking. And then the extreme retaliation, which is our very, very low probability case, would be things like China selling treasuries, or retaliation against U.S. companies that are in China, stuff like that. I don't think that that's very likely, but we just put it on the table as a possibility. So right now we're watching the tit-for-tat, and then going forward we're hopeful there'll be some sort of negotiation.
So does that give you confidence that it doesn't really change your investment profile much, and a lot of the companies that you look at, the likelihood of their being impacted significantly by escalating tensions is pretty low?
Well, it's quite interesting because remember, it was probably 6-8 months ago now when the steel tariffs came in. So we held one steel company. We have a portfolio of 35 companies. We had one steel company. So we crunched the numbers and it made less than 1% impact to EPS. So we're like, okay, we're fine. And the stock promptly sank 20% just because people were worried about it. I don't know whether they weren't crunching the numbers. It was fear had taken over. People were, you know, shooting first and asking questions later. And so that was a very good lesson for me as a portfolio manager. So when all this other stuff happened, and a lot of it has to do with the tech supply chain, a lot of it has to do with different sectors, and I said to my team, we are not taking the risk that we crunch these numbers and it doesn't have an impact, but the stocks go down a lot anyways. So at that time, prior to a lot of this escalation, we shifted the whole portfolio to domestic demand stories. So we don't own any Chinese exporters, literally not one. And that sounds like it would be hard to do, but really, if you look at the sectors that we like, technology, so we don't own any of the Chinese sort of supply chain companies. So the technology, Tencent, it's domestic demand. Alibaba, domestic demand. JD, domestic demand. Weibo, domestic demand. So all those tech companies, particularly internet, are domestic demand. We own a lot of financials. So again, that's insurance. That has nothing to do with trade. We own two insurance companies. We own two banks. We own Hong Kong Exchange. Those have nothing to do with trade. So the portfolio has really been shifted towards domestic demand, and it's been there for 6 to 8 months now. So I guess the more interesting, or the next question for a portfolio manager would be, what if there is a solution, or even some sort of negotiation or a thawing of this relationship? What do you want to be buying that's gotten really oversold? You know, it's the classic babies have been thrown out with the bathwater sort of market. So right now we have a list of babies that have been thrown out with the bathwater. And if the trade negotiations go well, and if there is some sort of even initial resolution, there's some interesting stocks that are out there that we could buy.
That is it's an incredibly valuable perspective for people who hear the noise about tariffs and trade wars and get anxious and aren't sure where to put their money. They know they want to buy the story longer term, but they're nervous about the short-term impact of some of the geopolitical issues. One approach our investors are taking, so they also really love the China tech story and the idea of internal demand for China tech. And the approach that they're taking, so through NabTrade, they can buy directly in the US, the UK, Germany, and Hong Kong. So Hong Kong is one of the options, the other is the US, and they will buy Alibaba and Tencent, are the two big names that our investors will buy. It's a bit of a new trend for our investors, so they've moved away from the FANG stocks, which they were previously very keen on buying out of the US, and starting to move into Asia. What is fascinating about that, and perhaps something people are less aware of, is that you've got your FANG acronym in the US. There's a really similar trend in Asia also. So you've got your four-letter acronym and these huge dominant tech stocks that people are probably much less familiar with.
Yeah. So that's a great point. So the tech analyst at our fund was telling me the other day that the new FANG is actually called MAGA. So there's all these acronyms. You really have to be on top of your acronyms to be a tech analyst these days. Yeah. So it's Microsoft, Apple, Google, and Amazon.
Right?
Because some of the FANGs, but you know what it also? It stands for Make America Great Again. Sure Donald Trump is thrilled with this. But anyways, some of the FANGs have really run into quite a bit of trouble, like Facebook, obviously, with the congressional testimonies, and then it fell off a cliff. Netflix had quite bad earnings and fell off a cliff. Twitter is obviously not a FANG, but it also had some really bad earnings. So it seems like in the US there's a shift away from some of these social media into more established tech. So that's where MAGA has come up. Anyways, there is whether it's the MAGA equivalent or the FANG equivalent, there is, like you say, an equivalent in Asia of these mega cap tech stocks. So the acronym is STAT. That's what we like to call it. So that's Samsung, Tencent, Alibaba, and TSMC. The interesting thing about STAT is that they're not all the same kind of companies. So obviously Alibaba and Tencent are e-commerce and social media. Well, Tencent is sort of a technology conglomerate.
Everything,
it has social media, but it has cloud, and it has stakes in JD, so it has some e-commerce also. But nevertheless, and they're both Chinese, and they both have mega cap, you know, over 400 billion market caps. And then you have Samsung, which is obviously Korean, and it, you know, a lot of people think it just sells phones, and maybe you have seen a Samsung washing machine or something like that. But they actually have.
I think we have a Samsung fridge as well.
Yeah. Yes, we had a Samsung washing machine, and it actually broke down, and I had to deal with the fix-it guy. And I was thinking, I can count this as, you know, company due diligence.
Yeah.
But anyway,
real-time experience.
That's right. Yeah. So, and then you have Samsung, which is different, but they also have a whole sort of supply chain business in terms of memory and semiconductors, which supply Apple. A lot of people don't know that. So that's a big part of the Samsung business.
Wow.
And then there's also TSMC, which is obviously one of the biggest chip makers in the world, but they're Taiwanese. Mm. So unlike Fang, which is all US and it's, you know, all very specific, STAT is different. It's across countries and it's sort of across subsectors within tech. One of the distinguishing things that we like to say STAT versus Fang or MAGA is that the environment for tech in China and in Asia is very different than the US. So in the US, you know, I'm sure you've all seen Donald Trump going after Amazon, and he's constantly tweeting and saying they're
policy by tweet.
Exactly, they're trying to, you know, take down retailers and stuff like this. You know, Facebook, everybody saw Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress, and you have a lot of regulatory risk in the US. In China, it's not really the same thing. You would never see President Xi out there tweeting something about Alibaba and how they're putting retailers out of business. It would just never happen.
I don't think I ever anticipated we'd ever see a head
that's
of state
true,
tweeting
yeah.
about a company. That's new for all of us, I think.
Yes, that's true. So it's sort of a different environment. China, I mentioned before, the technological arms race. This is a topic that we have done a lot of work on internally. And China wants to win the technological arms race. This is not the Cold War. This is the tech war. And you know, you're not going to shoot your own big tech companies in the foot if you want to win the tech arms race. Mm-hmm. So it's a much more supportive environment in China. That's my view. And then obviously Samsung and TSMC are in different operating environments. And they are to some extent beholden to what happens with Apple, because they are suppliers of Apple. But these are really long-term thematics that are playing out. One of the things I didn't mention in terms of disruptive technologies is the Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. So as you know, Internet of Things in really basic language is that there's going to be a chip in everything. So if you think the world is heading there, owning one of the biggest chip makers in the world is not a bad idea. So that's why we like companies like TSMC. But overall, we're very comfortable staying in the large cap Asian tech companies. The thematics are good. The valuations have come down. They're quite reasonable now. We meet with these companies all the time, and the you know, medium term forecasts look very strong.
So this is really interesting. I mean, the tech arms race, I'd love to talk more about that, because the arms race was a very different experience. The tech arms race sounds a little bit more positive for humanity. I mentioned that NabTrade investors will buy Tencent, for example, in Hong Kong. Now, what has been really interesting, obviously they've been hurting lately. That hasn't been the most positive experience for them. And it's because the Chinese regulators were happy to step in and actually impede their ability to do business. So you're saying it's a supportive environment. They've just had a bit of a rough experience. Does it look like those regulatory risks are going to play out? So in the US, you've got regulatory risk around Facebook and Amazon and so on, with frankly, a head of state who doesn't like them very much and has some concerns, but also Congress asking a lot of questions. China, you're not concerned about those issues?
So it's important to highlight exactly what's happened with Tencent and the regulator. It wasn't that the regulator came in and said, there's something terrible about these games, we're shutting them all down. There's actually changes in the structure of the regulator. Mm-hmm. And so as those changes are going through, nothing is getting approved. Yeah. So that's different than we've identified a problem and we're proactively going after this problem and we could continue to do this forever. Sort of on Tencent, you know, they had earnings last week, mm-hmm. which were somewhat disappointing, but as your investors or, you know, investors who watch it very closely will know, the stock actually went down less than 2% the day after and then went up 3% the next day and 3% the day after. So those disappointing earnings had largely been discounted in the price at the time. Nevertheless, is what we're waiting for. On the conference call, they did say that, you know, when the regulatory body sorts itself out and it's back to making approvals, mm-hmm. We will know, and we are going to buy more stock, or we will look at buying potentially more stock at that time, because that hurdle has gone out of the way. They also mentioned something they have. It was along the lines of like green tracking, or so that there's you know, there is a process that they're trying to do in the meantime while the regulator is being restructured, so that these games can continue to be approved. I guess the last thing I'll say about Tencent is it's not just about games. Mm. So when I do my modeling on games, on Tencent, you know, you have the games line, you have the advertising line, you have the other line, and then you have all these sort of hidden value part in Tencent. So a lot of people don't know this, but Tencent has a huge stake in JD. They have a stake in Tesla. They have a stake in, they own Tencent Music, which is like the Spotify of China. They have stakes in a lot of things that investors probably would have never heard of. And if you add up all those stakes, there's billions of dollars of value that's not reflected in the stock price. So I get a really decent target price on a sum of the parts value right now. And I think once this regulatory issue is sorted, there's a lot of value in Tencent.
That's there'll be a lot of people very happy to hear that, I think. Yeah. So you've talked about the approach of buying domestic companies with exposure to China. I would love to play that out a little bit, because I can absolutely guarantee you most of the people listening will have had at some point a Bellamy's or an A2 Milk or similar in their portfolio, very explicitly because they're trying to get access to the Chinese market. Now, they've been hurt by that, again, for regulatory reasons, you know, at various points in time where things have not gone smoothly. Do you think that's one of the reasons that you would maybe not play it from the domestic market?
So my overall view on this comes from my time at Soros. So I worked at Soros Funds Management, and this was in the early 2000s, and I'd done all this work, and it looked like the Brazil economy was in big trouble, like really big trouble. So I was a banks analyst, and I looked around the world what banks have really big exposure to Brazil, and it was some of the Spanish banks. So I went into Robert Soros, that's George's son, office, and I said, I think we should short the Spanish banks, because there's, you know, you go like this and there's 10 degrees of separation, you'll get to Brazil and this is going to be really bad for him. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's a terrible idea. if you have a stimulus, you play the thing that's closest to the stimulus. So if you think Brazil is going down, we should short the Brazilian real, because the whole thing is going to crater. Don't play something that's four countries away in a different sector and has, you know, only 10% of their book in Brazil. You're just diluting what you think is going to happen. So this is part of my problem with people who go via Australian stocks to get to China. Mm. If you like Chinese consumers, just buy a Chinese consumer company. You go straight to the stimulus that you like. Don't do it indirectly, because you'll lose some of the benefit on that indirect path. I guess the second thing is that a lot of those companies are small caps, and they come with all the issues that generally small cap companies have. And lastly, they're not cheap. So, you know, this, as I said, the rise of the Asian consumer, particularly the Chinese consumer, is not a new thematic, and a lot of people have piled into them. So what you're paying for the level of growth that you get from the Chinese consumer in Australian stocks is way more expensive than what you get in terms of if you go to China directly. So that's why I always encourage people, just go directly to the stimulus that you're trying to play. Don't do it indirectly, or you'll lose what you're trying to achieve.
That's a very important lesson, I think.
It was.
It's a hard one for us all to learn, I think, one way or the other.
Yeah.
Do you mind talking out those valuations, just to give people an idea of the magnitude between what you pay for earnings in Australia versus what you pay for earnings going directly to China, for example?
Yeah, this is a great point. So we are a growth fund. Elishan Asia is a growth fund. We think that Asia is the best growth, structural growth story in the world. And so, you know, why would you go to Asia for value when it's a growth market? Mm. So we only invest in growth companies. And we like to look at what we call what is known as the PEG ratio. So that's the P divided by the growth rate. So it gives you an idea of what you're paying per unit of growth. And we try to look for companies that are trading around a PEG around one. So that means if you have 20% growth, and your PE is 20 times, you're trading at a PEG of one. If you have 20% EPS growth and you're trading at 40 times, then you have a PEG of two. So we try to get everything around one. Like you asked before, the numbers currently in Australia, if you look at ASX 200, the PEG is around 3.8 times. So what you're paying for around 15 times PE and 4% EPS growth. That's 3.8 times. And if you look at our portfolio, we have about 20% growth, 20 times PE. That's 1 times. Now, our portfolio may be a little bit different, because that's what we're looking for in Asia. The PEG in Asia may be a little bit higher, but it's just over 1, between 1 and 1.5. It's not 3.8. The US is in between Australia and our portfolio. So in terms of growth, if people want a growth element in their portfolio, and this is something I hear from Australian investors a lot, there's no growth domestically. I own the banks because I need the div yield, but I have no growth anywhere. And a lot of investors solve that problem by going down the market cap curve to look for small caps. But another strategy is to go overseas, particularly to Asia, because there are lots of growth companies.
Where things are growing like mad.
Yeah.
It's so one of the things I've been talking about with guests on this podcast is the risk of using passive strategies when you're looking for diversification and you're not quite sure how to access the strategy that you're after. So you buy a passive strategy, buy an ETF, for example. I'm a big fan of ETFs, I have to say this, so I do own some in my own portfolio. But I'm nervous that people will buy an ETF and they're not necessarily clear on the composition of the index they're tracking. Now, you mentioned earlier that China's now moving into some of the MSCI indices, which is a huge move. I would imagine a lot of investors weren't aware it wasn't in there in the first place, right? You know, one of the largest economies in the world, the largest stock market, as you say, how on earth can it not be in there? So do you mind talking us through, A, where the large Asian economies sit from an index perspective, and then also whether or not there is any value in using passive strategies in these kinds of markets?
Yeah. Okay, I'll answer your first question first. In terms of the big global indices, there is a lot of confusion out there. I hear a lot of feedback from investors. So the first thing is, there's two world indices. One is MSCI World. Mm-hmm. That is a developed market indice. Mm. So the index. So the only countries you get exposure to in Asia are Singapore and Hong Kong, because those are the only two that are considered developed. So you get no India in there. You get no China in there. You don't even get any Korea. Mm. And so I have. And then there's the MSCI All Country World Index, which does consider emerging markets. But even then, you know, China is 3%. India is 1%. Mm. They are tiny, tiny, tiny allocations. So for example, an MSCI All Country World, India is about 1%. You would have more exposure to the Netherlands than you would have to India. You have twice as much exposure to Australia, a market you're trying to get out of, than you have to India if you're in MSCI All Country World. So I guess the first thing is, people need to know, if you're buying an ETF, what is it? And what countries are in there? What stocks are in there? I guess that would be the first important thing. Regardless of which indice you're looking at, Asia is underrepresented. And this is one of the reasons why we're so bullish on Asia long term, is that there is no way, if you look at the economic forecasts, by 2030, four of the five largest economies in the world are going to be in Asia. China will be first, US second, India third, Japan fourth, Indonesia fifth. And there is no way that you could have global benchmarks that still have 75% in the US and Europe when you have the largest economies in the world that are all in Asia. So we think that the long-term story in terms of funds flow is definitely towards Asia. So, you know, I guess the first thing is, make sure you know what you own if you're buying an ETF. But the second thing I would say is that, you know, in a lot of these emerging markets, they're not efficient markets, and there still is a lot of alpha to be generated by stock picking. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing I'll say is that, at Ellerston, we take ESG, environment, social, and governance, very, very, you know, we put a very high priority on that. And in some of these markets where people are not familiar with the stocks, I think it's important that you have someone that you trust looking at them, mm-hmm. and who knows the management, who's on the ground meeting with the companies, and who knows what's going on. If you just buy the whole index, there's going to be a lot of stuff in there that you may not necessarily want to own. Yeah. They're not going to be high quality companies. You don't have anyone looking what the governance is. You don't have anyone looking what the environmental and social implications are. You don't have anyone looking at you know, whether management is executing properly. So, you know, Howard Marks, who's the founder of Oaktree Capital, and I work for him at Oaktree, he's often said about ETFs, yep, they're a fine asset class, but you need to ask yourself, how much of your portfolio are you comfortable with no one watching? And so if you're comfortable with no one watching huge parts of your investment portfolio, that's fine. Personally, in Asia, I prefer to have someone who's on the ball and actually doing the work on the specific companies.
Thank you. I think that one... Yeah, as I said, I'm really happy to hold ETFs, and I do for sort of large, fairly staid markets. I think it can make some sense, but I think in some of these smaller markets, small, not relative to the economy, and certainly not small relative to the growth, but small relative to people's understanding of them and their holdings for people who live in developed countries, perhaps it might not be the way to go. Outside of India and China, so you've been really clear that they're big favourites of yours. Which areas do you think offer some interesting opportunities, and which are you staying away from?
Okay, so in Korea and Taiwan, we do have investments in Korea and Taiwan, but they are almost exclusively in tech. And the reason is, as I said before, we're a growth fund. And Korea and Taiwan, I don't know if you've been there or any of your listeners have been there recently, they're definitely not developing countries. I mean, they have very high GDPs, the infrastructure is built out. It's like being in Sydney or in Hong Kong or anywhere else. And so we find that the growth opportunities in those sort of economies that are growing 2 to 3% and have developed economy characteristics are much lower than what you would find in an India or a China. So that said, there is a lot of amazing tech companies there, so that's why, and they have high growth that's driven by a number of different factors. That's why we own tech there. So we like companies like Samsung, and TSMC, as I've mentioned before. So Korea and Taiwan are primarily tech. And then I do like the Singapore banks. Mm-hmm. So one thing to watch out for in Asia is liquidity. So a lot of these smaller markets like Indonesia, Malaysia, and Philippines, if you have any risk off in emerging markets, and we are seeing that right now, particularly with Turkey, mm-hmm. and before that there was Argentina, the liquidity in those markets dry up very fast and the markets fall quite quickly. So I don't own any stocks in those three markets. Nothing in Indonesia, nothing in Malaysia, nothing in the Philippines. This is an important thing about Ellerston Asia. We're benchmark unaware. So mm-hmm. if I don't like a country, I'm not there. I don't feel the need to have to be invested in there because they're part of my benchmark. So those, I guess right now, those are some economies that I would avoid. But I do very much like the Singapore banks because they are highly, highly liquid. So even if liquidity dries up in ASEAN overall, you'll still have lots and lots of liquidity in the Singapore banks. And the Singapore banks, because of the structure of Singapore monetary policy, they're actually beneficiaries of rising rates in the US. And this is a concern in Asia if, maybe the trade war proves to be inflationary, or maybe you wake up one day and the Fed has hiked significantly and the US 10 years at 4%. That's typically a bad outcome for emerging markets. Mm-hmm. So as a portfolio manager, you need to be careful that you're buying stuff in emerging markets that will be a beneficiary of that. Mm-hmm. So the Singapore banks, basically what happens is as US rates goes up, SIBOR, which is the rate in Singapore, goes up, and the net interest margins of the banks go up. So they perform quite well in that environment, and that's why I'm comfortable holding them right now.
That's a new one for us. It's a really, really good one.
Learn something every day.
You do. Yeah. Mary, you currently manage the Ellerston Asian Investments listed investment company and also an unlisted version of the same underlying portfolio. And you produce some excellent insights that continue out this conversation, things that people can learn every day about this area. How do people stay up to date with the sort of information you provide?
Oh, great. Well, thank you very much for asking, Gemma. So first of all, you can go to our website. Almost everything gets posted on the website in real time, just on the front page. And then there's also an Ellerston Asia specific tab that has all our things, our newsletters, even if you want to read stuff that's been posted previously. You can also connect with me via LinkedIn. We found that LinkedIn is a very positive tool for keeping in touch with investors. Or if you want to be in our distribution list, then feel free to contact our investor relations and we can set that up for you.
Awesome. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today. That was really, it was so insightful, and it's very rare that we get something that people are completely unfamiliar with. Very excited about talking about India, which people will get to hear about soon.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Your Wealth podcast. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.